There's no place I'd rather be on a cold winter's morning than in this room worshiping Jesus with you. I know it's a little weird maybe, but and being home in front of the fireplace would also be great, and a lot further south would also be great. But this is Sunday morning, and you're my faith family, and this is where I want to be, and I'm glad you came in spite of the snow. The hazardous road conditions, it's great to see you. I'm glad that those of you who are at home watching online are also with us. Grateful for the technology. I think it's fully possible to take for granted the experience that we have together every Sunday. I know for years I did, especially when I was a teenager. I thought it was like watching peeling paint. It was so boring. But I left that view, and I have a totally different view now. In fact, I grew out of that view even then. Last week, one of our visitors said that she'd been going to church all her life, but this is the first time she'd ever attended an a cappella worship assembly. And I've heard that from several other visitors, and you never know what you're going to hear them say next. I mean, maybe they'll mention that they missed the instruments. But this woman was amazed and enthralled. She said that she felt like she was in a choir, and that's not the first time I've heard that comment either. I've heard that comment several times. To have these moments, but then to have them be not simply about the beauty of the singing, but rather that God allows us to be vessels or vehicles to be able to lift our hearts up to God and to hope is a wonderful gift, and never take that for granted. Many people today feel conflicted about pursuing a relationship with God because the idea has been drilled into them repeatedly that smart people don't believe in God. And you can go online in the comments section of many articles today. Smart people do not believe in God. And that's, first of all, that's a lie, because smart people do believe in God. And most of the smartest people over history have all believed in God, and they continue to believe in God. But Dallas Willard has often made the point that getting life right is surprisingly uncorrelated with having a high IQ. He said, you know, did you ever notice sometimes smart people do dumb things? And I don't know about you, I think I'm smart, and I do dumb things all the time. So I guess it's true, smart people do dumb things. There's the old joke, we've all heard it before, Michael Jordan, a Nobel Prize winning physicist, a grandfather, and a Boy Scout are on a plane. There's engine trouble, the plane goes into a dive, the pilot comes out of the cockpit and says, the plane is going down, everybody save yourself, and he grabs a parachute and jumps out of the plane. The problem is there are four people still on the plane and only three parachutes. So Michael Jordan stands up and says, I was the greatest basketball player ever, the world still needs me, he grabs a parachute and jumps out of the plane. The physicist stands up and says, I'm the smartest person in the world, and the world needs smart people, and he jumps out of the plane. The grandfather looks at the boy kind of sadly, and he says, you know, I'm an old man. I've had a good full life. You're young. Your life is all in front of you. You take the last parachute. I'll just go down with the plane. The Boy Scout said, relax, mister. The world's smartest man just jumped out of the plane with my backpack. Old joke, still funny. Strikes a chord with a lot of people as funny because it pointed out something ironic but true, which all good jokes do. You just look all around you. Really smart people do really dumb things all the time. Just watch the news. Watch a sports event. Read a newspaper article. I mean, if you still do that. Smart people do dumb things all the time. And one dumb thing smart people could do would be to reject God, because they think that's what smart people do, and a lot of smart people don't, and they have good reasons to believe. So I want to spend a little time this morning talking about why faith in God makes more sense to me than the alternative. I don't think there are airtight proofs for the existence of God. I don't think God gives us those. I think he's a little shy in that way. He wants us to seek him before we can discover him. So the question is not really, can you prove the existence of God beyond a shadow of doubt, even if you believe it beyond a shadow of doubt, which I do. The question really is, does believing in God, having faith in God, trusting God, does that make more sense than basing your whole life on the belief that there is no God? So I want to run through what you might think of as clues, I guess, this morning that I think point to God, but more importantly, I want to get to the best reason for believing in God, because the best reason is not reserved for people with really high IQs or that even hear these arguments. The first reason I want to suggest is put in the form of a question: where did the Big Bang come from? I remember when I was in junior high and high school, I was interested in these kinds of things, these kinds of questions, and that's the question I always wanted to ask someone who's arguing that God doesn't exist. I said, where did this come from? And he tells me, you know, what he thinks, where he thinks the world came from. Where do you think the world came from? Where do you think the sun came from? Where do you think the stars came from? Where did that come from? You just keep asking that question, and eventually, what do you get to? Either I have no idea or nothing. And the general scientific understanding was that matter, the physical universe, before the Big Bang theory became popular in the 19th century, about 100 years or so ago, it became the predominant theory. I think it was about 1927, so we're not quite there yet. That was the general understanding was that matter had always existed. I remember junior high, high school, they called that the steady state theory. Things have always been just like this. And that doesn't, you know, you take a telescope, those who know those sorts of things, and they studied distance and movement and all, then they could say, no, there's nothing steady about it. All moving around all the time. In fact, it's exploding outward all the time. But that was the general accepted theory. But the Big Bang Theory, as I said, became prominent about 1927. And the Big Bang Theory, turns out it provided answers to problems in many different fields: mathematics, chemistry, biology, astronomy, and so on. And so there's a strong scientific consensus around the idea of the Big Bang today. And there's a fascinating little book called The First 3 Minutes, about the very beginning of our universe. It's always hard, at least for me, to wrap my mind around the concept that in the beginning, all the matter of the universe, physicists tell us, was compressed into a tiny point of infinite density, what is spoken of as the singularity. And then the universe had a beginning. It was not, and then it was. Now, here's why that points to something like God, I think. It's a very simple argument. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. Nothing just magically pops into existence. Cell phones, a new tree growing in my backyard, the ice and snow that are still on my driveway, a slice of pepperoni pizza. Every object or event has a cause. When I was a teenager, I think I believed that the mere existence of pizza was a proof of God. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. Nothing just pops into being out of nothing. The universe had a beginning, therefore something caused the universe. And think about the alternative. The alternative is believing in something coming from nothing. There's nothing, and suddenly there's something. How much faith would it take to believe that? A mom hears a crashing sound coming from another room, and she yells to the kids, "What are you doing?" And what do the kids always say? Nothing. What do they always say? Nothing. But they're never doing nothing. They're always doing something. In fact, we are never doing nothing. Our hearts are beating, we're breathing, we're thinking, we're talking. Nothing would be complete blank emptiness. So now try to imagine this for a moment. There is no space, there's no time, there's no matter, there's no energy, there's not even a void, because a void kind of connotes boundaries and a container or something. There is nothing. And then with no explanation, no cause, the universe pops into being. Suddenly there is something. It does not work. You cannot get from nothing to something. If you want to be an atheist, the existence of the Big Bang is what might be thought of as an inconvenient truth. For the physical universe must have been produced by something not physical. The existence of the universe itself points to the existence of something beyond the universe, something that does not depend on anything else for its existence, something of immense power, something that has a quality, something like what we think of as a mind. John 1:1 says, "In the beginning, in beginnings, was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Before there was any matter, there was the mind." A second clue that I think, you know, points to the existence of God is what Paul was writing about 2,000 years ago to the church at Rome, when he said in Romans 1, verse 20, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. I've talked to you before about how meaningful that is to me. To go look at, you know, Utah, where the bare bones of the world are visible, or anywhere, you know, just even outside my backyard and look at a tree or look at a leaf or blade of grass. It proclaims the handiwork of God. The existence of the universe is a reason for believing the fact that there is matter, that I can look at my wife or at this lectern or at my own hand, and it's a proof that something happened, that something caused this to happen. The second clue, I think, points to the existence of a God is what Tim Keller used to call the cosmic welcome mat. Now, the cosmic welcome mat refers to this oddity about our universe. Physicists, secular religious, have come to call it recently the anthropic principle. From the Greek word anthropos, which means man or human being, the universe seems to be fine-tuned to be the kind of place that can support human life. Doesn't have to be that way, but it is. There are a striking number of conditions, contingencies in biology, chemistry, and physics that would have to be just right for life to arise. It turns out, guess what? They are just right. For example, I know if I'm going to lose a bunch of you for a while. Hold on for 10 seconds and we'll be done with this. They tell me that the proportion of the mass of a neutron of hydrogen that's converted to energy during a nuclear fusion, which makes the sun go, the proportion of the mass of a neutron of hydrogen that's converted to energy during nuclear fusion is 0.007. If it were 0.006, the whole universe would be hydrogen, and there'd be no life. If it were 0.008, there'd be no hydrogen, and again, no life. What physicists call the strong force happens to be exactly what's required to produce life. The precise orbit of the Earth is distance from the sun. The existence of a moon that keeps the Earth tilted on its axis 23.5 degrees makes a climate that can sustain life. In fact, physicists, whether religious or secular, say that we live in the Goldilocks zone. The Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold, just right. I was watching on YouTube just the other day, a young scientist was talking about what the chances are of life on other planets. He said, you know, we've always thought there are millions of other planets in all of these solar systems, all over the universe, millions of other planets, and surely at least one of them is just like the Earth, and it can produce life and has produced life, surely. But he said, actually, when you actually do the math and you take all the variables, it turns out the chances are not. There are just too many variables that fall in perfectly in place for life to exist on Earth. He said, the chances are you could have millions and millions of other planets, and none of them could sustain and support life. I thought that was interesting. The Goldilocks zone. Water, you know, has a unique property. As water gets colder, it contracts until it freezes, and then it reverses course and expands. If it did not have that very strange property, oceans and lakes would freeze from the bottom up. They would freeze solid, which would make aquatic life and therefore life in general impossible. This anthropic principle is an overarching name for the fact that there are dozens of variables like that. The strength of gravity, the properties of carbon, the exact rate of the expansion of the Big Bang, on and on and on in the universe, in our planet, in biology, that would have to be exactly fine-tuned for life to exist. And it turns out, guess what? It's exactly fine-tuned. Ironic, when Copernicus demonstrated that the Earth revolves around the sun, rather than vice versa, a number of people said in subsequent centuries, well, the human race will just have to recognize everything doesn't revolve around us. We're accidents in a huge universe. But instead, particularly in recent decades, we've discovered in ways that previous centuries could not have imagined that the universe looks strangely like it was designed precisely so that we could exist. A physicist by the name of Freeman Dyson said, it's as if the universe saw us coming. The anthropic principle, I think, is a reason for belief, but it's not the best. I don't base my belief on that, do you? A physicist by the name of Freeman Dyson said, it's as if the universe saw us coming, but again. Another clue that I think points to God is the longing, the hunger we all have for meaning and beauty. Where did that come from? One of the things that happened last year is a lot of grandparents or grandchildren were born to members of this church last year. And even in other places, a lot of you became grandparents last year. That's a miracle. Oh, and children too. A lot of you had children. That's also a miracle. Something that happens with regularity in this church is beautiful. And one of the highlights of our year is our annual baby dedication service. It's so encouraging. I was thinking this week, as far as I know, there are no atheist ceremonies to mark the arrival of a human life. Why would there be? What would you say to a little baby at an atheist ceremony? Little baby, you're a little blob of carbon, a random collection of molecules on an insignificant speck of a planet revolving around a minor league star that will someday burn itself out and destroy all known life forms. Long before that, you personally will have rotted and decayed, and your momentary existence will be eternally forgotten and without meaning or significance. Have a good life. Hard to picture that catching on. My favorite philosopher, a guy named Nicholas Ulterstorff, has written a number of great books. I recommend all of them. One of the most recent was written in 2010. He's an older guy. It's about justice. And he raises the question in that book. He's a philosopher from Yale. Why do human beings have dignity? Why do we have value? Why do we have worth? Why do we have rights? Why are there such things as human rights? Where do those come from? His book is an attempt really to found justice on the notion of human rights, which he believes are very important. But he asks this question: if children are beaten, if women are marginalized, it's wrong. We all have the sense that it's wrong. Why? Now, it turns out that secularism has a very hard time establishing a foundation for human worth and rights. We're all just accidents. There's nothing, no purpose, no meaning, no rights. And that's not to say that secular philosophers don't value human rights. They certainly do. But it's hard to find something to ground them on. If you ground them in certain human capacities or abilities, then when those abilities get diminished, then to that same extent, those rights would get diminished. What would be the point? Why would there be any worth to someone if they're handicapped or they have a mental illness or some other issue? The Nazis explored that. But we have this sense that all human beings, whatever their IQ, whatever their capacities, there's a notion of human rights. And it turns out there simply has never been a foundation for them. Like, human beings have worth and rights, except for the fact that they are precious to a creator who made them and loves them, and therefore they are of value. A notion, and he explores this. Where did that come from? And he goes back in history and explores, where did that notion come from? And he decided it comes from the pages of the Old and New Testament, and not before then and not after then. Over time, out of that notion, there grew an explosion of this value of human rights that's become so woven into our world and our day that we forget it has not always been apparent. We hold those truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Those aren't just pretty words. They're not just political rhetoric. Those are very serious ideas that human beings spend a lot of time thinking about and looking at the implications of. Now, this fact that we hunger for meaning, for purpose, for worth, does not prove that meaning exists, does it? But we have a hunger for food. Be a very strange world if there was no such thing as food that existed when we have such a hunger for food. We have a thirst for water. It'd be a very strange world if no such thing as water existed. We have an appetite for sex. It'd be a very strange universe if no such thing as sexual activity existed. We have a hunger for meaning. It strikes me that it would be strange to have a hunger for meaning in a meaningless universe. A hunger for meaning is a reason to believe, I think. But again, not the best reason. Another indicator that points, I think, toward God is what might be called the argument for arguing. How many people in here have ever been in an argument? You don't have to raise your hand. I already know. C.S. Lewis, in his work, Mere Christianity, makes this point. He says, when you listen to people argue, they don't say, do what I want because I'm stronger than you. Well, they might. But that's not really, we all understand that's not a valid reason to do what I want. Or we say, I can make you do it, so do what I want. We automatically know that's not a valid reason why we should do it. When we argue, we say things like, but it's not fair. It's not right. It's not just. In other words, we're arguing. When we argue, we betray the truth that we believe there is a moral standard and that it exists quite independently of our own preferences. We all do this. Everybody does this when they argue. Even online, even those people that are atheists online appeal to the same kind of logic. Now, I know somebody might well claim to you that they believe in relativism, that value is really just matters of personal preference, but I'll guarantee you, if you attack one of their values, if you say, for example, I think racism is a good idea, or I think exploiting children is fine, it will turn out that they don't think those are just personal preferences. They believe those things are morally wrong, independent of how anybody happens to feel about it. They're still wrong. Everybody knows there are transcendent moral realities, and of course, we are finite in our capacity to understand them, but they exist independently of our personal preferences, and we all know about this. Again, the Apostle Paul wrote about this a long time ago. He said in Romans 2, verse 15, the requirements of the law, as right or wrong that God has woven into existence, the requirements of the law are written on their hearts. He's talking about Gentiles who didn't have the Old Testament. These requirements of the law are written on their hearts. Their consciences also bearing witness. They have consciences. They know when they've done something wrong. Very central dynamics to the human condition. And their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. On what basis? Our innate ability to judge what is right and wrong is, I believe, a very powerful reason to believe in God. But not, again, the best reason. Another clue that points to God, I think, is what might be called the second Big Bang. First Big Bang is when the universe came into existence. That cries out for an explanation. But there's another Big Bang. The primary reality that we all live with is that one day we're going to die. One day you are going to die. And the thing about death is dead people always tend to stay dead. It's permanent. That's not a new discovery. It's not something stumbled upon by biologists in the 19th or 20th century. The human race has always understood dead people remain dead. So how do you account for the explosion of the early church, the Big Bang? There were many messianic movements in Israel around Jesus' time. In every case, the would-be messiahs were executed by Rome or died of natural causes or some accident. And when they died, that was the end of the movement. It's over. They proved themselves not to be the Messiah because they died. As a matter of historical reality, here's a massive community of radically different nature springs up virtually overnight. How do you account for that? How did a group of deeply monotheistic Jews come to worship a human being as divine virtually overnight? Not something out of nothing. How did Christianity explode so rapidly with no resources, you know, political or military power or any of those things, no resources with such power as to overtake the Roman Empire in such a short period of time? Virtually all the disciples and early leaders of the church actually died for their faith. First-rate historians, including Luke Timothy Johnson at Emory University, have come to the conclusion that the only explanation offered that accounts for the explosion of the early church is that Christ was actually raised. The French thinker Pascal wrote, I tend to believe those witnesses who get their throats cut. People simply do not die for what they know to be a lie, not by the hundreds and thousands, when they know it's a lie. They might try to profit from a lie, but they don't sacrifice their life for it. The explosion of the early church in the Roman Empire is a powerful reason to believe, and many people believe because of that. But I don't think it's the best reason. The best reason, the main reason, is not an argument at all. It's a person. And I don't have a better way of putting it than this. Jesus comes shining through in strange places, unexpected ways. Through our inadequacy, Jesus comes shining through. I know him, and many of you do too. Sick a woman that I've known, spent 20 years alone in a nursing home, should have been bitter and miserable. Instead, she glowed with joy of another kind, and when asked of what she thinks about all day long, she said, and she said it all the time, I think about my Jesus. He's been awfully good to me, you know. I've heard others say almost those exact same words. People who have experienced all kinds of hardship and tragedy and say, I think about Jesus. He's been awfully good to me. A very bright, wealthy, attractive young man loses everything and winds up incarcerated in San Quentin. And there, through a bunch of prisoners with life sentences in a prison cell, Jesus comes shining through and he finds a life that he never knew when he was in the penthouse. A boy living in a hut in Uganda, orphaned by AIDS, who should be hopeless and despondent, instead gives hope to the American who's trying to help him, because there in that hurt, in that hut, Jesus has come shining through. A lawyer whose secret alcoholism finally becomes unmanageable and robs him of his career and his possessions finds in the dingy basement of a rehab center in a circle of drunks, Jesus comes shining through. It happened one day to a murderous, self-righteous Pharisee named Saul. It happened to a scandalized, isolated tax collector named Zacchaeus, to a humiliated lawyer named Charles Colson, to a convicted murderer named Jesse Bicken, who I personally taught and baptized. Jesus comes shining through. In places of enormous human despair, gloom, and loneliness, in the unmatched beauty of his life, in the unrivaled brilliance of his teaching, the man on the cross calls out for us to join him once more. He has come shining through in my life. The man of sorrows meets people in their tears like nobody else. The crucified and risen one meets people on their deathbed like nobody else. The best reason has a face and a name, Jesus. He comes shining through. And one day this happened. Little baby was born into our world to a poor and uneducated couple in a backwater corner of the world. How do you explain the impact of that life on this world over 2,000 years later? Who else in history has a place like him? Whose birthday is the second most celebrated birthday worldwide? No idea. What human being is the second most worshipped after him? Maybe the prophet Muhammad. Whose name is the second most popular swear word when somebody misses a putt on the golf course? Don't do that. What is it about this man's life? No one group or tradition can contain him. And sometimes he comes through Christianity. Sometimes he comes through in spite of Christianity. It happened to me. Jesus came shining through. And I can't imagine my life without him. It happened in 1930 on an island in the Philippines. A man named Frank Laubach. He became a leader of the world literacy movement. If you've ever heard the phrase, each one teach one, that was Frank Laubach. He became an advisor to the U.S. president and helped shape U.S. foreign policy after World War II. If you ever heard of the Marshall Plan that rebuilt cities out of the ashes, he had a fundamental role in that. This is what he wrote. Laubach wrote this. The most glorious discovery that has ever come to me is that I do not have to wait until some future time to be with God. This hour can be heaven. Do you not see that God is trying experiments with human lives? That's why there's so many of them. His question is, how far will this man, how far will this woman allow me to reign in their life this hour? Jesus comes shining through. Doug Coe was the head of a little prayer group in Washington, D.C. Arthur Burns, the head of the Federal Reserve, attended one of that group once, and he was a newcomer, asked Arthur Burns, he didn't know who he was, he asked him to pray. Burns was Jewish. It was kind of an awkward moment. Duck didn't know how it would go. They all bowed their heads, and this is what Arthur Burns prayed. Lord, may all Jewish people come to know Jesus. May all Muslims come to know Jesus. May all Christians come to know Jesus. When we think of Christians, we often think of a religion or a subculture, a political movement, or organizations and certain beliefs. But knowing Jesus is entering into the reality of an interactive relationship with a living God, and he comes shining through if you know him. Anyone can do that. You don't have to be smart. It begins with humbling myself. This is what God said through the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah 66, verse 2. But this is the one to whom I will look, to the humble and contrite in spirit who trembles at my word. He will look on you. Is that you? Let me ask you a question. Have you ever known a really smart person who was not humble? I've never known or even heard of one. Really smart person who's not humble. Humility is such a beautiful quality. It's not smart to avoid it. But if smart people or clever people or successful people or strong people or pretty people or young people or wealthy people, we have a problem with it. Andrew DelBanco, Columbia University, was doing research on how Alcoholics Anonymous. So he started sitting in on AA meetings. He said on one occasion, the guy who was telling his story clearly had huge problems. His life was falling apart. He couldn't control his drinking. But to hear him talk, nothing was really his fault. He was very smart. He drank because he's surrounded by dummies, he said. He could brilliantly rationalize every choice he made, every step he took. He could not acknowledge his own selfishness. He could not, in any meaningful sense, say, I was wrong. Couldn't say it. Everybody could see this man's arrogance and pride except himself. Another guy at the meeting, dressed in ragged clothes and dreadlocks and shades, he leaned over to DelBanco and he whispered, I used to feel that way too, until I achieved low self-esteem. I just love that line. That'll give you something to talk to your therapist about. Next time you go into a session, I like to achieve low self-esteem. Help me do that. What does that mean? It doesn't mean thinking I'm not worth anything. It doesn't mean hating my existence. It means to recognize I am a sinner. Part of my sinfulness is pride that blinds me from seeing the truth about me. So we ask Jesus to help us see our spiritual needs for what they truly are. And if you do that, you will be humble. Then we repent. Our humility leads us to want to change. We seek with God's help to let go of our sins and turn to pursue a better life. It's recognizing our need for a Savior. We need a Savior, and Jesus is the Savior.